Accessibility Craft Podcast, where we explore the art of creating accessible websites while trying out interesting craft beverages. This podcast is brought to you by the team at Equalize Digital, a WordPress accessibility company and the proud creators of the Accessibility Checker plugin. And now, on to the show.
Now, I am very excited to introduce Joe Dolson. I added a spotlight, so you should all be able to see him. If you're not familiar with Joe, he is a WordPress plugin developer. He's a web accessibility consultant. He owns a company, as I mentioned before, called Accessible Web Design. He's part of the WordPress accessibility team, which works on WordPress core, and he's a WordPress core committer and contributes, I think, is that 6 hours? Might not be accurate
that
anymore.
It's much more than that. No.
I'm looking at this bio and I'm like, I'm pretty sure Joe contributes at least 20 plus hours to building WordPress each week.
Officially, I contribute 12 hours a week.
Oh, okay. 12 hours. Seems
that's
like
the official amount of time.
12 hours per week. And he is also on the board of the WordPress Accessibility Day nonprofit with me and was the founder of WordPress Accessibility Day conference. He teaches WordPress accessibility on LinkedIn Learning. So he is pretty much the de facto WordPress accessibility expert is what I'm trying to tell you. So I'm so excited to have you here and thank you so much for coming and speaking with us, Joe.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
I'm going to let you take over sharing. I am going to turn my camera off, but just so everyone knows, we have the Q&A module available in Zoom. So if you have any questions as Joe is talking, if you can put them in there, I will come back at the end of the presentation and pass those along to Joe, and we'll do Q&A at the end. Thanks, Joe.
All righty. Well, thank you very much. And I am really glad to be doing this talk. This is a little bit unusual for me as a talk goes, because it's really a lot less technical and it's much more about planning and strategy. It's really about the long term. This whole talk is basically about what happens next. Because what we have really is a scenario where you build a plugin or any kind of application. Really, this talk is applicable to almost any kind of software. You improve it, you end up with this great accessible tool, and then regressions happen. So this is really about regressions. This is about what happens after you've made your application accessible, because really it's not enough to make your application accessible. It needs to stay accessible. Most people with disabilities have almost certainly encountered accessibility regressions at some point, sometimes frequently. Everybody is frustrated by the miscellaneous design changes where settings move around and defaults change, and these impact people, but they're not necessarily huge problems in and of themselves. But accessibility regressions can be catastrophic, and they can be more frequent than other issues. So why does that happen? And what can we do about it? First of all, are they really common? I'm going to say just flat out yes. I'm going to raise a few examples of some major catastrophic cases, but the reality is they are an ongoing, constant issue. Regressions happen all the time. And this happens because there's really not a lot of implementation of automated accessibility testing in the ecosystem. The automated testing that does exist, and all automated testing, is fundamentally limited. It doesn't do an enormous amount to actually resolve all of the potential problems, because user testing focuses almost entirely on new development and doesn't tend to look nearly as much as it should at everything you've already done, and because development just tends not to prioritize accessibility. So how real is this? What are some real-world examples? Well, I'm going to first start with a case study on Notepad++. Now, Notepad++ is a fairly popular application. It's a simple text editor for writing code. It's not a full-on IDE. It just has some basic tools to help make writing code easier. That's kind of where I got my start, writing HTML from scratch in 2000. We'll leave the numbers out. That was a long time ago. But version 8.3.0 that released on February 4th, 2022, was completely 100% unreadable with any screen reader. Now, obviously, this is a catastrophic change. Anybody who is attempting to use it completely lost that ability. So what happened? Well, it was based on a technical change where they changed from a long variable type to an INTP variable type to manage character position representations. That's highly technical and you don't need to know the details. But screen readers were accessing this via something called the Scintilla API, and it expected a long variable type. Because that failed, all screen readers were unable to access it in any way whatsoever if it was on a 64-bit system, which honestly, the vast majority of systems were 64-bit at that point. This is obviously a devastating problem. You know, a lot of people are developers who are screen reader users, and they require these tools. And suddenly losing all access to the content, and in fact, on NVDA, it actually caused Notepad to completely crash, so you could really get no information at all. But disastrous. And it was fixed because screen readers released updates that branched how they treated that API based on the system architecture so that they could read the content in either environment. So what went wrong in the Notepad++ development? This technical change actually made sense. It was necessary. They needed to do it in order to support a certain type of file, essentially large files. But they did no accessibility testing of the release and had no, and therefore had no upstream communication to screen reader makers. A very simple test could have caught this problem, and they might have just needed to delay the release to communicate upstream and say, hey, we have this problem, we need to do this, what's going on? And the difference would have been significant. If they had done even a single test with any screen reader, they would have quickly discovered they couldn't do anything. So that's kind of a catastrophic example of a lack of testing. Now I'm going to look at another type of study. This is the Sonos Smart Speaker app. Sonos speakers are a tool for basically sound management in your audio system. They released a brand new app that they rebuilt from the ground up in May 2024. This new app almost completely broke every aspect of accessibility for users. The new app was released along with discontinuing their existing web interfaces, and their previous app had been highly accessible. Now, the fact for both of these applications that before these problems, they were already very accessible is a lot of what caused this to be a big deal. I have to be a little hypothetical to talk about what happened internally at Sonos, because they don't have a public development environment where you can look and check in on this, but you can make some fairly straightforward guesses about what was happening. Clearly, they didn't have a lot of good testing. But mostly, I feel they had a premature release. And they failed in that process to take accessibility into consideration. And they failed to recognize that losing accessibility of an existing application creates a significant degradation of their service. How was it fixed? Well, it was gradual improvements in the app, which they had predicted. They had actually informed people that was going to be what happened. And as of July 15th, there were public presentations reporting that it was possible to use, but definitely not as good as before. So this is a solid 2.5 months after release. It's just, it's okay. What went wrong? So this is Sonos's announcement on accessibility prior to releasing the app. They stated explicitly, on May 7th, the app will have basic support for screen readers, allowing you to swipe through and read through all items on the screen. Following launch, ongoing improvements to the accessibility of the updated mobile app will remain a top priority. A software release available May 21st will improve screen readers so you can select items on the screen in any order. Further improvement will be added to the experience regularly until we reach parity with the S2 app by late June. So You may already be realizing there are some big problems with this statement. This announcement is basically ethically indefensible. I'm going to break it down a little bit. First of all, they say basic support for screen readers. Okay, what is that? What does basic support for screen readers mean? To me, it means everything can be read, everything can be interacted with, and screen readers work. Because anything short of that is not support for screen readers. The next thing I have to call out is that you can swipe through and read through all items. Oh, I'm sorry, this is an interactive app. If all you can do is read items, then I don't understand how you're supposed to be able to use it. You're in a situation where now you're expecting somebody else to actually control this, but at least you can find out what's going on. May 21st will improve screen readers so you can select items on screen in any order. Okay, so you already know that 2 weeks later, it will have better accessibility. Why are you releasing today? Why not delay for 2 weeks? And finally, you will reach parity with the S2 app by late June. Okay, so you have a plan. You have a schedule for accessibility, and you know exactly when you're going to achieve the level of accessibility you want. So why did you release it on May 7th? What was the reason that you couldn't wait 2 months to release a version that wasn't going to leave a large percentage of your customers in the dust? Because really, here's one of the things about an app that is accessible, and that's that people invest in that product. Screen reader users bought Sonos environments. They spent thousands of dollars on speakers and systems so that they could use this because it was accessible. By making this kind of a release plan, you are effectively telling them, oh, well, we don't really care about your business. I mean, we'll get there. It's fine. You know, 2 months without listening to anything isn't a problem, right? So clearly this is a problem. So obviously you're probably thinking to yourself at this point, how exactly does this apply to WordPress products? So of course, there are some significant differences going on when we talk about WordPress. WordPress is very different from these apps. Very few WordPress plugins or themes actually are highly accessible. If you've spent a lot of time looking at WordPress plugins and themes, as I know some of you have, you know that there are a lot of accessibility gaps. Most of those that have become accessible, for example, you've got Gravity Forms, which is really only accessible on the front end, are in their first phase of accessibility. Now, when I say first phase, what I mean is this is the first time that they have brought their application into the realm of being accessible. So right now they're in that improve phase. They are gaining clients because those clients care about accessibility. And they are at the point where now, if they want to make future changes, they have to be prepared for what might happen. And of course, in the WordPress environment, most changes are in fact highly gradual. Relatively few plugins do a just gigantic rewrite of everything so that now it's a completely different fundamental code base. That is one of the reasons that Sonos app had so many problems, is rather than revising something, they scrapped it and started over. Sometimes there's a good reason for doing that, and that's okay, but it is a risk. There are certain types of changes that always have to be watched out for. And this is going to be true in all products, but particularly when we're talking about WordPress products, what exactly is going on? One of them is what I like to call long-term degradation, and I'll go into that into some depth. There's component and dependency updates. This is what happens if you're dependent on a particular system. Say you're using jQuery UI and jQuery UI releases an update. You are dependent on how that changed. The way it changes is what defines for you how your interface actually works. And then, of course, as I discussed earlier, there are major refactors. So long-term degradation. What exactly does that mean to me? Because of course, this is my talk and I made this up. So this is all what I think. Let's hypothesize. Launch day is today, November 18th, 2024. You're really excited. You've got your new product out. Woohoo! There's a graphic on the screen that is a very colorful woohoo. It's rather comical. This application is fully tested with users with disabilities, and it meets all known and active accessibility standards. It meets all the best practices. This is really great. This is fabulous. Okay, so 10 years later, we now have a graphic which is the same word, woohoo, but it's in graffiti on a concrete wall. Everything's looking a little rough. Is this still accessible? Does it meet today's standards? And does it use today's best practices? And that's actually a fairly complicated question. First, how do we actually define accessible? I tend to kind of break this up into three subsections. The first one is it possible to use? The second one is that it meets standards. And the third one is that it's pleasurable to use. It's actually a good experience. So what's possible to use? 10 years later, it should still be possible to use. I mean, the reality is, if you've worked on something up to conforming with standards, the fundamental fact about conforming with standards is that they are comprehensible by software. The software knows what to do with something that meets some past standard, and so it's undoubtedly possible to use, barring some kind of major technological breakdown. What about meeting standards? Well, this one is a little bit more complicated. If it met a standard previously, it will still meet that standard. That's just how standards work. But meeting standards is not about being accessible. Meeting standards is about being consistent with a recognized set of guidelines. You could still today create an application that met WCAG 1.0. You can still write code that conforms with HTML3 if you want. That would meet standards, but it doesn't make them good. It just means they meet a standard. 10 years from now, WCAG 2 will be 26 years old. It really shouldn't be the foundation of any accessibility standard 10 years from now. Whether you will meet a standard that's recognized in law 10 years from now, with WCAG 2.2, for example, well, you might. Laws move painfully slow sometimes, and that might be the case. So what I can say is you will meet a standard. Whether you'll meet the best standard, the recommended standard, or the legal standard is not something anybody can predict. Will it be pleasurable to use? This is where things start to get really into the rough. Whether it's pleasurable to use or not can ultimately only be answered by a user. And this is where user expectations really start to come into play. So who knows? Maybe it'll be pleasurable to use, maybe it won't. But let's talk a little bit about what some of the types of user expectations that can change whether something is pleasurable to use or not might be.
This episode of Accessibility Craft is sponsored by Equalized Digital Accessibility Checker, the WordPress plugin that helps you find accessibility problems before you hit publish. Thousands of businesses, nonprofits, universities, and government agencies around the world trust Accessibility Checker to help their teams find, fix, and prevent accessibility problems on an ongoing basis. New to accessibility? Equalized Digital Accessibility Checker is here to teach you every step of the way. Whether you're a content creator or a developer, our detailed documentation guides you through fixing accessibility issues. Never lose track of accessibility again with real-time scans each time you save, powerful reports inside the WordPress dashboard, and a front-end view to help you track down hard-to-find issues. Scan unlimited posts and pages with Accessibility Checker free Upgrade to Accessibility Checker Pro to scan your website in bulk, whether it has 10 pages or 10,000. Download Accessibility Checker today at equalizedigital.com/accessibility-checker. Use coupon code ACCESSIBILITYCRAFT to save 10% on any plan.
So here's an example from one of my own plugins, the WP Accessibility plugin. When I built it in 2012, I added a feature that allows you to display long descriptions, basically takes the description field from the media library and presents it as an overlay on top of that image, triggered by a button so that you can read it. And you know, it was a fun, cool feature. And at one point when we were building the WP Accessibility Day build, Raghavendra Satish Perry, who was performing some accessibility testing on the site, flagged it as an error. This was in 2022. And that was a little bit of a catch to me. I had to think about that. I was like, oh, wait, I built that myself. But I hadn't actually looked at it in 10 years. It hadn't needed change. It hadn't had reports of problems, so I hadn't really looked at it. And it was, in fact, possible to use. But it didn't meet the normal expectations a screen reader user had for interacting with something in 2022. What changed? Bluntly, it was the existence of ARIA. The why ARIA specifications were transformed into a recommendation in 2014. And in 2012, I wasn't using them. But today, it is a broadly supported and strongly expected feature in any website. So this can happen at any point. Anything you do is something that is potentially going to be changed later on. And you just have to be prepared for that. A general takeaway here is very simple. Whatever the best practices were in 2014 aren't the recommendation today. And whatever the recommendation is today will not be the recommendation in 2034. So you need to start planning ahead. So now we start talking about defensive accessibility. Another term I'm just coining because that's apparently what I did with this talk. How do you protect yourself against this kind of gradual degradation down the line? One of the first things to do is really just to date things. Keep track of when your component was last reviewed. When was this feature last remediated? What is the oldest piece of UI you actually have? Look at change logs when you upgrade a dependency. Just having a date gives you at least a reference. You can kind of jump back and say to yourself, you know, this particular search feature, we haven't reviewed in like 8 years. Maybe we should really just check it over and make sure we're doing the best we can. This is always something that changes. Not being broken isn't the same as being right. You can also build ahead. Use features that aren't supported yet. This is actually one of the things that affected me with WP Accessibility. I could have used the ARIA expanded attribute. It was somewhat supported, even though it wasn't actually a recommendation yet. But at that time, I was choosing not to use things that had not yet become standards or were not yet supported by browsers. But the reality is, it's frequently a lot easier to just remove a polyfill than it is to rebuild your component. If it's already using the tools that it should be using, you just stop faking them using your polyfill. And the reality is, this is a bit of a risk. Not all unsupported features will necessarily always be kept, but a lot of them will. And a lot of them will actually be improvements. One example now might be something like the ARIA controls attribute. It is minimally applied by any browser or AT combination. And it may never be, but there's no reason not to use it now, because at some point it might actually have a distinctive function. Right now it's mostly used as a way to figure out in your code how this event actually should trigger. But it can be anything. Next, you just test with users, and you test continuously. It's not all about just limiting your user testing to whatever you're now working on, whatever is new. And you just have to monitor for new user expectations. You have to recognize that if the user's expectations have changed, that doesn't mean that you made a mistake. It just might mean that now you have something that depends on prior expectations. This is also something that's going to really help you catch unexpected consequences earlier. This is the kind of thing where with that Notepad++ problem, if they just were doing testing as a routine behavior, that would never have happened. They would never have released something that had that much of a huge break. It seemed innocuous, but in fact broke the entire application. It's easy to hear the comment that you don't hear feedback from people with disabilities, so you're not worried about things. So you assume things are fine. And that's essentially based on false assumptions. It's based on the idea that people are using your product when it's maybe not accessible. But that changes if your product becomes accessible. Fundamentally, losing accessibility from an application is radically different from lacking accessibility. Lacking accessibility will prevent people from using your application. But what they will not do is they will not invest in using your application. Losing accessibility is where you have something that people have invested time and effort in. They have built their products, they've built their website using this tool, and now it suddenly becomes inaccessible, and they can no longer use their website. And that's disaster, because people should be able to expect to continue to be able to use the applications that they purchased. Now, in the WordPress environment, there are always complications. And this is one of the things about the fact that the WordPress stack is very deep. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the front-end complications that we get when we're trying to push updates to any plugin that has a front end. Essentially, you know, this is something that applies to me in a lot of ways. I have a calendar plugin, which is events management. I have a ticketing plugin that allows people to purchase tickets. Both of those have a lot of front end. They are very heavily dependent on what's going on up with the user. And of course, that means that I have to manage changes to those front ends. When the code changes, I have to somehow make that work. How do we manage front-end change in a WordPress plugin? We can stage changes and introduce them gradually. We could introduce a new model. We can selectively enable it, let users selectively enable it. That's basically what Gravity Forms did. They now changed to a completely different version, and all new installs get that. And you can turn it on if you want to. And you can increase specificity in your CSS. And that's kind of mostly that's what your options are. And they all have, unfortunately, some downsides. So when you're staging your changes, basically you're just embracing that you're going to have an ongoing cycle of minor breaking changes. You are in lots of releases, release after release, you're going to I'm going to break whatever custom CSS you might have had for this feature. And then next release, I'm going to break this for that feature. And that can be really difficult. That certainly isn't something that will win you friends with your users, since you know nobody really enjoys having to constantly reconfigure their custom CSS to make things work. But it is a strategy. Introducing a new model comes with the downside that really only a small percentage of sites will even get those changes. You know, like with the Gravity Forms example, an enormous percentage of sites were just still using the legacy HTML, and that had all sorts of problems. So that also has flaws. If what you're trying to get is to have people overall have a much more accessible experience, that only gets your future users. increasing the specificity in your CSS can be quite painful. I am personally heavily biased towards weak CSS in my plugins. I prefer it to be easy to override. But that also means that it can be really, it's very easy for them to accidentally override, which is to say, all sorts of themes override my CSS and other plugins override it, and that can be a real hassle. But if you make it too specific, then it becomes really difficult to override, and user design choices sometimes just get lost. So these are all things that sometimes just have to be worked through with a WordPress plugin. When refactoring, you have a whole different sort of set of issues. Now, I'm going to be totally upfront here. You know, refactoring is something where I have actually the least experience. Or I should say, refactoring something that's already accessible is where I have the least experience. I have done a fair amount of refactoring, but usually it's going from something that is not accessible to try and turn it into something that is accessible. And that is a completely different problem. Refactoring something that's already accessible has a different challenge. This is essentially what Sonos was needing to do. But in my hypothetical, in how I imagine this would be best done, you start by interviewing your users. You have just a few questions that you really need to try and get from them. And the first one is, what are, in fact, the accessibility strengths of your application? What is it that people like about it? Because there's kind of a broad sense of, you know, if it's really accessible and all of the technical aspects are correct, that's great. That doesn't necessarily mean that the application is delightful to use. It can just mean that it has a lot of strong characteristics. But what do they actually like? This is something that Sonos really could have done. So on the screen here, I'm showing you a screenshot of the Sonos app before their redesign against a screenshot following after their redesign. In the one before the screen, before the redesign, down at the bottom of the screen, there's a series of five tabbed controls. They allow you to flip between My Sonos, Browse, Rooms, Search, and then there's a more that gives you access to additional features. And that is gone in the new version of that screenshot. And one of the big complaints, one of the things that really was hard on people with this architectural change, was the fact that the new design put all of the features and all of the controls into a single long screen. Whereas previously, they'd had a lot of grouping. There'd been four different sections. It was easy to find the specific type of thing you were trying to do. Now, that's not really relevant to the accessibility problems that they actually released with. Those were about the screen reader just couldn't get any information about any of the features on the page. That was lacking accessible names for controls. But in fact, they made a fundamental architecture change that was less desirable to their users who are using screen readers. And that's one of the reasons why, when I was talking about some of that July post that was talking about the fact that it was more accessible now, but still not as good as it was before, it wasn't as good as before because of the choice they made and how it was architected. So now, interviewing your users, of course, there are a lot of stakeholders in a project, and there's no guarantee that that interview is going to make it all the way through to the final product. But at least if you're aware of what your users actually want from your application, what makes it easier to use for them, then you can try and avoid making those sorts of changes that will actually make it just fundamentally more difficult. And of course, you also want to ask them, what are the accessibility weaknesses of your application? Again, just because your current interface might be technically perfect doesn't mean that it's easy or pleasant to use. It might be just difficult to navigate. It might be difficult to figure out where things are. Maybe the labels are just not as clear as they could be. There are all sorts of ways in which an interface can be technically accurate without actually being easy to use. You can use this refactor as an opportunity to improve these things, to try and make them all just better. And you'd want to just try and differentiate between just meeting standards and providing that great experience. A refactor can be a great opportunity. It's just that it's also an enormous amount of change. And involving users with disabilities in the process of working out what a refactor should look like can be incredibly important. Ultimately, this is all about needing to prioritize accessibility. One of the hugest things that Sonos did wrong was releasing their app before they implemented the accessibility into it. And it might seem like this isn't necessary to say, but if you're releasing an update that isn't accessible, you're releasing broken software. It's just that simple. If you've been working on improving accessibility gradually, you've been working on it across many versions, you might be accustomed to thinking that it's okay to ship with some broken accessibility. Because in the process of improving, you're continuously making things better. So yeah, some things are still broken and that's okay. But once you have an accessible application, you actually have to think very differently. It is no longer okay for something to ship while it's broken. Before your application was accessible, you might not have had any users who needed it, because it's not because they didn't want your application. It's not even because they maybe didn't need your application, but they couldn't use it, so they didn't. But once it becomes accessible, that period is over. They will be using it, and that's good. So what I don't want is for anybody to walk away from this talk with the idea that you shouldn't make applications accessible, which is an easy takeaway, because you know it's so much easier if you're just gradually fixing broken things. Once you have an accessible application, now you're like, oh my God, I can't change anything. But you can. You need your application to be accessible. People can acquire disabilities, so even if they purchased your application in a place where they could use it, they might have acquired a disability, and now they should still be able to use that application. They might be forced to use it because of employment. You don't want to have an inaccessible application that can cause you to lose customers who can no longer use it. You don't want it to cause anybody to lose a job. So it's important to make sure you're prioritizing, you're testing early, you're testing often, you're distinguishing between having a lack of accessibility and actually having broken something that was previously accessible. I think what I want as my biggest takeaway here is that accessibility doesn't end once you've made your product accessible. That's just the first stage, because you still have to continue to improve your process. You have still have to continue to improve your product, but you have to do that in a way that doesn't lose some of the great features you've fought to have in that first place. And that's my whole talk. So if there are any questions, I'm here for them. I will stop my share.
Do you want to, before you do that, just read out your website and...
Oh, you mean if case somebody actually wants to find me or something?
Yes, where's the best place for people to find you, Joe?
Well, you can find me on my website, which is joedolson.com, or you can email me, joe@joedolson.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at Joe Dolson. You can theoretically find me on Facebook, but I probably won't respond. But anywhere
I
am,
I think I might
I'm
have
Joe
tagged
Dolson.
You in the WordPress accessibility Facebook group recently. And
you
I was
did,
like, Joe
yes.
might know the answer to this. But
you
I
did.
Don't know that you did answer it.
I have not, no. I think your answer was fine, just for the record.
Oh, thank you.
All right. So with that, I will now stop my show.
So if anyone has any questions for Joe and you want to put them in the Q&A, we'll be passing those along. I did see one come in via the chat, so I'm going to start there. And this is not specifically related to what you were saying, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. So Maurice had said Maurice supports a number of clients and is moving them to WPMU Dev Hub to give centralized control for updates, et cetera. Do you know of an accessibility testing module that works in that environment or reports over? Have you ever seen that?
I've never used the WPMU Dev Hub. I don't know anything about it. So I would be well out of my knowledge base to actually respond to that. I assume that you're basically looking for something that would take the global reports and feed them back into your hub. Seems like it should be possible, but I honestly don't know anything about it, so I couldn't guess.
We actually have some of our sites set up there because we use our uptime monitoring, which is kind of handy. And like Smush Pro. But I haven't seen any accessibility that coordinates with that. Maybe it's a good note for us on Accessibility Checker.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of benefit to being able to pull those types of reports into a centralized hub, because if you're managing a lot of sites, I mean, that would certainly be valuable in the education world. You know, they tend to be very heavy on huge, complicated installations that have many, many things going on. But I don't know anything about it.
So Maurice had followed up with a question in the Q&A that you were talking about accessibility for developers of plugins. But how do you feel like your talk and like the principles that you were discussing apply just in general to websites that are being developed and developers of websites?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely applies. I mean, websites tend to have the complication that there are also non-developers working on them. They tend to be more fundamentally chaotic just because it's so much harder to get a clear picture on everything that's happening. Obviously, there's a lot of different types of websites. You know, there's everything from the hobbyist who does everything themselves to the heavily managed professional experiences where everything goes through a review process before it gets published. And in that latter case, it's much easier to make sure things kind of stay on track. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely relevant. There's no question. I mean, fundamentally, a website is software. It's a software application. It happens to be one that's assembled from a whole bunch of dependencies, which are plugins and themes and WordPress. And those all have the same fundamental consequences. You know, whenever a plugin updates, you really do need to look and see what has actually changed here and has it gotten better or not. I have absolutely had experiences where a plugin got worse from the accessibility standpoint. And that almost always happens because they have it decided to implement some form or another of a third-party UI tool. You know, like now suddenly they're using UI.
Like a library for carousels or something.
And suddenly like, oh, great, this has now gotten bad. And it's frequently simple becomes complex. But it's the same fundamental tool.
How do you handle that when you encounter that on websites?
I mean, on websites that I actually manage?
Yeah, like your client sites.
Well, I don't give my clients a lot of freedom to install things. And so I might be a somewhat domineering manager. So I will just remove it. I have a very particular set of clients, and my clients are not necessarily, they're not always the most knowledgeable about digital accessibility, but because so many of my clients are disability-focused nonprofit organizations, they do care about whether or not something is accessible. So I have a large degree of freedom to simply make changes and tell them that I have made these changes if they've done something that isn't accessible. It is a fabulous privilege to be able to just change a client's site without asking them.
Yeah.
So I try not to abuse it. If they've put something up that's extremely important in an inaccessible manner, we will have a conversation first. But I have
And then I'm
definitely just taken
assuming
things out.
you, there's like a line of, do you try to go to the plugin developer? Do you fork the plugin? Do you just remove it and say, nah, we're not going to have this functionality at all, right? They're trying to figure
I
out
mean,
based upon the
yeah, it
different
kind of
scenarios
depends.
how to address it.
It really depends on how important the functionality is and how replaceable it is. But I also build an awful lot of custom software. And that has a lot to do with habit. That has to do with the fact that I have been doing this for a very long time. And when I was building accessible websites with WordPress in 2009, there were zero
Not very many
accessible
plugins.
options, so all I ever did was fork things or write custom stuff. And to a large degree, I still do that. So it is kind of weird. I have a very low level of trust for plugins.
I mean, I don't know that I think that is weird, given the plugins that I've test all the time. Same thing. So,
Yep.
yeah. It is an unfortunate reality, maybe
It
right now.
is. It is
Hopefully
very
that will
much
change. So,
fingers crossed.
I want to follow up on Maurice's question, then we'll go back to Nick's, because Nick's is sort of, or Maurice's is sort of related. So he asks, would it be correct to assume that you recommend testing sites for accessibility when making updates to plugins? And what would you say the cadence is of updating things and testing them that you'd
I mean,
recommend?
it really depends on the plugin. And that ha because it has so much to do with how are you actually using this plugin and how, I mean, there's a certain fundamental trust level. It's actually very, I would say it's almost identical to my policies when it comes to security and plugins. If I really only install plugins that I have a pretty high level of trust for, and that includes trusting that they're not going to make big changes unexpectedly. Now, it's hard to tell sometimes whether any given plugin is using semantic versioning or not, but in general, if it's a third degree update, I am very unlikely to do any additional testing. I mean, they're going
So
from.
that's like for people who are less familiar, there's like 1.1.1. So for versioning controls, you're talking about those
Yeah,
third decimal point
if it goes to
changes.
1.1.2, probably won't check it. If it goes to 1.2.0, might check that. It kind of depends on what the change log says. And if it's a first digit change, then it's probably going to get staging and a detailed examination before I do anything, because that's probably a really big deal. Different developers use different systems, but I don't think very many would release 1.1.2 and just feel it's okay to Mac completely revamp their UX. That would be weird.
Hopefully not. Do you have a list of trusted plugins?
Don't really have a list, but I do tend to kind of install almost the same things everywhere. But I will be blunt, it's very short. And
Can you
the
name
majority of the
any?
plugins I
I'm gonna put
use,
you on the spot.
I mean, I trust Gravity Forms these days. It also depends on context because I don't if I have because with the clients I have, I frequently do have a need for the admin to be accessible. And in those cases, I do not use Gravity Forms because it's not there. And there I actually mostly use Contact Form 7, which is rough. You have to really know what you're doing, but it is possible.
With your accessible defaults plugin added to.
That just makes it a little easier.
So I might throw a link in the chat to, I don't know if this is a total overlap with yours, but last year people had asked this question for WordPress Accessibility Day, and we had put together a list of plugins that we use on our website, the WordPress Accessibility Day websites, which is not to say that they're all perfect, especially in all combinations, but they are ones that we use on the website and the website is accessible. So. Yeah. I don't know how else to word that.
Well, I mean, a lot of the plugins I use are almost exclusively admin side. So those just don't have a lot of direct impact on the accessibility of the site.
Yeah. Susan had a follow-up question on the contact form 7. Can you clarify what you mean by it is rough?
So what I mean is that editing a form in contact form 7 requires you to really understand HTML, short codes, and really just have a pretty decent handle on how to operate in code. It's not a visual layout tool. So it requires a higher bar for people to be educated to be able to use it. But it doesn't pose a whole bunch of barriers outside of knowledge. And knowledge is something that I can provide people with.
I want to follow up on Nick's question, and then I have a few others about like developing plugins, maintaining accessibility in plugins. So Nick had said that he worked on a new feature for WP Scripts package and was wondering if you know any gotchas for developing command line tools.
I mean, there's not a lot of gotchas for command line tools. The biggest thing is, you know, if you're doing like an interactive command line tool with, you know, an exchange of prompts, to make sure that those are sufficiently clear. But the reality is, I mean, the command line, it's just text. And anybody who's interacting with the command line, they need to be operating at a pretty high level to even work with it. You know, you have to be able to understand like that minus R has a meaning and it's very specific. So I don't know of a lot of really major gotchas to working with command line tooling. The biggest one is just, I think if it's an interactive thing, making sure that you aren't creating any kind of confusion. I would say, I mean, there are people who would probably have a much better answer to that than I do. Who actually
that sounds like a better answer than I would have given. So I'm curious, I want to dive a little bit more into talking to your users that you talked about. And I'm curious if you do this with your own plugins, and if so, how? Is it just via an email list, or like if you have good recommendations for people who maybe aren't sure if assistive technology users use their plugins and how to even get feedback from them?
Well, for me, it's specific individuals, people who I know have disabilities or are using specific assistive technology and are using my plugin. So it's very much, it's not email lists. It's literally, I reach out to my contact at NFB and like, oh yeah, we'll respond to that. That's the National Federation for the Blind. So yeah, it's very much, it's because I'm reasonably well connected. I know a lot of people and can get individual feedback reasonably well. That said, I also don't do a whole lot of big refactors. I tend to bias towards pretty small changes there. I have done a lot more of what I listed as bullet point one, where it's constant stream of minor breaking changes. And I've been doing that for 5 years. I think I'm, fingers crossed, don't need to do that again for a little while. But yeah.
So for someone who doesn't, then maybe it's reaching out like trying to look in the WordPress community or going to office hours and make, well, I know office hours might be changing.
Trying to get, you do have to reach out and ask somebody, and you should be prepared to pay them if they're not already doing it as part of their job.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality is, there's a lot of people who are willing to participate for free in helping to build open source software. But there's a very finite limit to how much time and effort most people are willing to give to that. And when they are, they want to choose what they're giving it to. So you shouldn't expect somebody to just happily contribute back to your random open source plugin. You should be prepared to invest in improving it and making that happen. And at the very least, you should make sure that, you know, you give them props in your, you know, next change log or release notes or whatever, because that's just fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's important feedback.
Yeah. I think there's a few community members you mentioned who might be worth reaching out to. So like Raghavendra Satishperry is one you mentioned who is
blind. He tends to be very generous with his time. Yeah.
But he also does paid auditing if people, you know, have budgeted for that and need something. And I think he has, his feedback is always very understandable. We've hired him to do some testing for us and our plugin. So he's someone I'd recommend. And there's some other people in the WordPress community. Alex, I think, does a little bit. Alex Stein, not Alex as much does volunteer, but I think you can hire him as a consultant. Kevin Andrews is another one. So,
Yeah. I mean, there's quite a few people. But yeah, finding them and making an arrangement. And I think one of the things that people need to always embrace is, you know, feedback doesn't have to be delivered in 20-hour contracts. You can get an enormous amount of data out of one 45-minute working session. And if you have developers who are able to watch that recording back and absorb that feedback and do some research and ask questions, then, you know, you can really make a huge impact just from that small amount of data. It's just extrapolating from original source and just going, okay, he commented on that. Well, we also are doing that over here and over here and over here. So maybe we should just get all of this fixed. So I always tell people that it's in your best interest to make your application as accessible as you can before I look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because it's going to take a lot less time and you're going to pay me less if it's already in better shape.
Yeah, I mean, for us, I feel like when we do audits, finding the problem is not really what takes that long. It's writing up what the problem is, how it maps to web content accessibility guidelines, and then what a recommended fix is. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what takes a really long time.
Yep.
So even just having someone get on Zoom with you and share their screen and giving them prompts and having them move around, like, hey, can you create a post in this post type that's your plugin manages, or can you, whatever this thing is, and don't tell them like where to go. Just be like, can you do this, and watch them try to use your thing or figure out where to go and how to do it. And I think that can give you a ton of usability feedback.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So Maurice had a question about your experience in the testing that is done by Automattic for changes in core. And I don't know if this is just an Automattic question or if it's really just like core contributors, or what's your, can you explain more about how testing works in WordPress core?
I mean, that is a big question. First of all, I don't think there's not much or any of the testing in WordPress core that is strictly Automattic that I'm aware of. There's a pretty complex test suite for both Gutenberg and for WordPress core. Gutenberg has some accessibility related testing, though not a lot. It does have visual regression testing so that we can actually track when something changes, which can be really helpful for kind of figuring out various changes there. But most of the tests are more functional. It's making sure this does that and this happens then. But, you know, Gutenberg testing, they actually have, there is a lot of keyboard related testing, making sure the keyboard events actually occur. It's just not, it's not done with the intent of it being accessibility testing. It's being consistency testing. So I don't know if that answers your questions, but
I mean, there's always a need for people to come in and test for Core, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
And Gutenberg. I
mean, and the thing is, it's such a huge, complex system. I mean, there's always things that can be tested. You know, the scope of problems and even just finding things is, can sometimes be exhausting. The number of times I've gone into a bug and I just, especially in Gutenberg, and I can't even figure out which screen it's on, let alone actually help resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
That can be complicated, which is why there's so much automated testing.
I'll ask you a kind of edgy question. Do you feel like the testing of features is sufficient before they're rolled out and released?
That's not even edgy. I don't think, I mean, I'm sure there are people who believe there is enough, but no, God, no.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being frustrated. I think this might be resolved now by the bug where any, if there was like a meta box at the bottom of the screen in the block editor, it would cover up the controls for the block that was above it. And you'd have to insert like a spacer block or something just to be able to like edit your paragraph or your heading levels or whatever.
Yeah.
And I, or like add links to things. And I was so frustrated by that. And then I found out that it's because the people who test for releases do it with like no plugins activated. And by default, there's only really plugins add meta boxes down there.
It's actually, it's an interesting thing. Part of the testing process, and this is part of the process to verify whether or not it's a core bug, is to test with all plugins disabled. However, some core bugs are only triggered by the presence of a plugin. So there do have to be some exceptions to that. Like there's a fundamental, we do still need to interact with plugins. But there are some complicated lines for trying to decide, is this, whose fault is this? Like, do we need to adjust for this or not?
Yeah. How do you, so I think there's kind of a similar line though, too, as you're developing your own plugins, right? How do you decide what other plugins or themes to test your plugins with?
Oh, you mean comparative,
like you personally,
compatibility?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious.
Yeah, that is complicated. And I haven't worried about it so much with plugins. I do some, you know, I like with anything that I have that has a payment gateway, I make sure that it still works if you're running EDD or WooCommerce. Because like I can't test every possible payment related plugin, but at least I can make sure that I'm not conflicting with those.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have a conflict with Give at one point that I hadn't found. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'll need to deal with that. So it is kind of hard because there's so many plugins and it's just, there's so much time you have to spend in testing with them. Mm-hmm. And then themes are, I mean, the thing, like when I was talking about front end complexities, like that is actually the hardest thing, is like so many themes do such weird things. And suddenly,
yeah,
like
the battle,
every single button has to have, you know, padding, which is 30 pixels on both the top and bottom and 80 pixels on the side. Like, oh my God, this is impossible. And it's important.
This is the battle that we have with accessibility checkers front end highlighter.
Mm-hmm.
We have,
I know,
tried so many
that.
Times to, on our buttons, unset theme styles. like for all the like padding, margin, like all the things, like the outlines, like everything. And yet still sometimes I'll get in with someone and I'll see the what are like button to trigger it, or like in it, like the one that's like view code or whatever.
Yep.
And it's like massive. And I'm just like, oh,
there've been a
it's
few
so hard to be
there've
compatible.
Been a few movements in the CSS working group to try and develop kind of an isolation layer in CSS, but it's so complicated, so difficult, and so frustrating.
I think that's probably one of the hardest things for plugin developers is figuring out how to make your plugin work in any theme, not knowing what you're going to get.
The ones I've seen that have been like consistent, like they are internally consistent and everything is the same, are inevitably things that are incredibly difficult to ever make any changes to. And it's just like, I don't like that compromise either. It was easier back in 2010.
When you just put important on everything?
No, when people building websites knew what they were doing.
As opposed to
The fact is,
all the drag and drop
so
tools.
Many modern drag and drop tools, people no longer have to know CSS or have to know HTML. It used to be the case that you really did if you wanted to make any changes. And
no, you don't.
It's interesting.
So Rishi said Rishi's been working with the USWDS, which is the US Web Design System, for anyone who's not familiar. It's the sort of like component library for US federal websites that is accessibility focused. So I'm working with USWDS recently with Gutenberg. Website is mostly accessible, but the backend is not. Do you know any component library which has good accessibility features for the backend?
I'm struggling a little bit to understand exactly what this... Do you mean that the...
Yeah, Rishi, if you want to put any extra context in the chat, that might help us and we can do it. I'm curious broadly, and I might have asked you this the last time you spoke, which was more than a year ago, but how do you feel about the accessibility of the backend of WordPress core?
I mean, it's improving. The full site editor is a pretty messy, and the integration between the block editor and the full site editor is complicated. But if we're talking about the actual, like the WordPress core, classic environments and settings and all of that, they really are making progress. That has been my primary focus for the last couple of years, is just getting those things adjusted. And it's been a lot because essentially we had opened, I'm just going to say, a lot of tickets about in the 5 to 8 year ago range. And then they all kind of got derailed by the Gutenberg development process. And so I'm kind of doing catch up.
Yeah, circling back.
So it's got all of the problems that you would expect from anything that is legacy software, because it has everything I talked about today, because it has things that were built 15 years ago and have hardly been touched since then. And it has things that are built in all sorts of different styles and languages and different kits. It can be complicated to work with. But it's mostly there. I mean, it's certainly not perfect. There's a lot of existing issues, but it's improving. We have real accordions now.
Very exciting. I know one thing you were telling me about, we were talking about some issues with like the settings with the way they're being output. If you do it the WordPress way in a table with like weirdness with the labels and things like that. And I don't know if maybe what Rishi was getting to, So specifically, there's some extra context there. Rishi says, I created custom blocks, but core controls are not accessible if there is any Gutenberg control library. So I'm wondering if that means like in the editor. And do you know if there's a library available for people to use? And like we were talking about the settings, you're like, it's probably better to just make your own.
Yeah. I mean, so are these blocks that you built, Rishi? I'm trying to figure out where the controls are actually coming from. Because in general, if you're building a Gutenberg block and using the current version of the Gutenberg API to do that, you really should have generally accessible controls as long as they're fully defined and everything.
By Gutenberg. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you shouldn't really be getting totally custom controls. I mean, you can build some weird stuff, but then if that's the case, it's not a Gutenberg thing. It's you've done custom code and it doesn't match.
Well, I've experienced this too. I audited a website where they had custom blocks, but they were using like Metabox, I want to say, or something to create the fields in the block controls that show up on the right hand.
I mean, there's some really complicated stuff you can do in blocks. I mean,
yeah.
And you can create a block that is basically a container for your own custom library. And in that case, you could end up with just about anything. I mean, you know, I was just reading the other day about the bridge that's importing the media library into Gutenberg, which is kind of interesting. It's complicated because, of course, the media library has to be kept isolated because it's completely an independent code base. That's kind of funky. But I don't know.
I'm not totally sure. A good answer.
What it is that you're trying to do, Rishi. But we can talk later. I know I have your contact information.
Yeah. So, those were all the questions that we had so far. I don't know if anyone else has any final questions. Otherwise, what I'd be sort of curious, Joe, like, as like a final wrap up thought for plugin developers who are trying to really keep things accessible. Do you have maybe like a high level how they can best, I'm trying to think about what I want to say, like map that out maybe? Obviously we saw the bad, right, with Sonos, where it's like, we're going to do a reversion and then come back to maybe better, which is obviously not good. But I feel like it's a planning issue, right? And why would you release something that's half-baked? And so I'm wondering if you have any recommendations on how somebody can say, okay, I want to do this big overhaul, or I want to do this thing. How would I map out accessibility along the way?
I mean, I think the first thing is to really honestly assess where you are now. Knowing what you have is kind of the key thing to figuring out what your risk is, what you might lose. If there's so many different cases here, depending on exactly where that plugin sits at the time they're doing this refactor. If where you are is, we've really never paid any attention to accessibility and we don't know anything about it, most likely your refactor will be an improvement, but not necessarily, because a lot of the time, if what you've done in the past was just very simple, then you might be fine, at least functionally, if not actually according to standards. You could be something that people can interact with, and then you upgrade it all to make it all React-based, and now suddenly people can't even interact with it. So knowing where you are is the thing that you have to figure out first. And once you know where you are, then you can kind of start to break down your components and be like, okay, well, this one is actually really accessible, so we need to make sure we don't lose anything. This one is kind of mediocre, so let's figure out what we want it to be. This one is awful, so anything we do is going to be an improvement. And then that you have a different level of investment concern about each different component. Obviously, the long-term goal would should be to make them all this great experience. But from a practical standpoint of, you know, wanting to keep your releases moving, you don't want to just hold everything steady for a year while you revamp everything. That's one of the reasons I think the WordPress plugins almost never do big refactors, is that there's a lot of pressure to continually release so that people don't
Updates.
start telling you that you've abandoned your plugin, which has happened to me. I had somebody ask whether I'd abandoned a plugin when I'd had literally been 2 months since my last update. And I was kind of like, really?
Because they're expecting like little micro releases every week or something, because that's what the really big plugins do.
And it's funny because it used to be different. You know, 10 years ago, people would complain if you released more than once every couple of weeks.
Because they didn't want to have to run updates, but now everything's on auto
Yeah, I know.
update,
It's weird. Things change.
yeah.
But anyhow, I do think there's really nothing better than just knowing where you are. And then your strategy at least can coordinate in relation to a basic level of information. And that doesn't mean you have to do like a detailed audit. You can have a kind of an overview of kind of have a user walk through it and just give you some insight and be like, okay, this was good, this was bad, this was mediocre. It can even be, yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways that information can come through. It all depends a little bit on like what is your actual budget for the work you're doing. I mean, let's be realistic. Some plugins are a solo developer working part-time, and they're going to have a different set of concerns than somebody who is a team of 35 full-time developers.
Yeah.
You know, different process. It's
For
kind of
sure.
inevitable. I say that as the solo developer who's doing this part-time.
Yeah. And a lot of other amazing things for WordPress. So, well, I mean, I think on that note, if you're not sure about the budgeting or the road mapping, come next month to WordPress
There
accessibility meetups. There
we
will
go.
be two
See, I
different talks
managed to
on
give you a
those.
lead in.
I don't know, that worked out very well. So, I really appreciate you coming and sharing your thoughts and your expertise with us. I don't know if you saw all the chats, but there were a few people that said, thanks for the great discussion. They really appreciated it. Remind everyone you're at Joel Dolson on just about all the channels
Yep,
and
pretty
in
much.
WordPress Slack. Yep. Okay.
Find me online. I
Great.
live
Well,
there.
thank you. Hopefully, we're all going to sleep now. Not doing too much
8:30.
more work.
All
Yes. All
right. Well, thank
right.
you so much for having me. Glad to be
Yeah.
here.
Thank you, Joe. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Accessibility Craft. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe in your podcast app to get notified when future episodes release. You can find Accessibility Craft on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And if building accessibility awareness is important to you, please consider rating Accessibility Craft 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Accessibility Craft is produced by Equalize Digital and hosted by Amber Hines, Chris Hines, and Steve Jones. Steve Jones composed our theme music. Learn how we help make thousands of WordPress websites more accessible at equalizedigital.com.